The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Weekly Connect, your place to check in with what's happening in the world of blind and partially sighted people, your place to share your stories in your own words, and your place to hear about the issues that affect you. If it's something you're talking about with friends, then it should be something we're talking about here. It's 2017, can you believe it? I just want to say Happy New Year to all our listeners. I'm Sean Priest, I'm your host for today. As you can expect, after New Year's, this place is empty, there's no one left, so I'm still in charge. But Stephen was kind enough to leave us a little message.
Hi Sean, it's Stephen here. I just thought I'd give you a call to check all was okay. Also to wish you a very happy new year, and also to everyone who's listening as well. I just couldn't keep away, quite frankly. But I did want to give you some important tips, Sean. Always remember, keep the microphone a hand span away, and remember the biscuits are in the bottom drawer if you're looking for them. Have a nice time.
Thanks, Stephen. Well, the chocolate biscuits were in the bottom drawer. There's just crumbs there now. Anyway, let's see what's coming up in this week's show. We'll be taking a look back at some of the highlights from the Weekly Connect of 2016. There's some great stuff in there if you're thinking about taking up a new hobby. Roger Cole talks to Laura about life on the links.
You know, you're jumping around for hours. It's madness.
Maggie Tolmy shares her experience of life on stage.
You get to be a complete idiot and people thank you for it.
And for the adventurous amongst you, Steve Bates shares his passion for climbing.
It was really important that everything I did, skills-based wise, had to be second nature, and I had to rely on my subconscious to do that.
That's all coming up on The Weekly Connect today. So if you've listened to The Weekly Connect before, you'll know that we're a forum to talk about everything and anything that matters to you, the visually impaired community. We've covered all sorts, from blogging to vlogging, from education to work, from shared spaces to space invaders. So let's kick off today with Stephen talking to the wide range of people we've had on The Weekly Connect.
So a number of our listeners, Steve, have been in touch about waiting times for a new dog, especially those who have already had a guide dog and are waiting for their next one. Can you tell us a bit about what Guide Dogs UK are doing to try and cut down those waiting times?
Yeah, I mean, I think every day a guide dog owner lives without their guide dog. It's difficult. You know, it affects their confidence. It has an impact on their family, on their ability to work independently, to move around independently. And it's an issue that we take extremely seriously. We work very closely with every single guide dog owner, understanding their needs, and our priority really is their safety, the suitability of a guide dog, and we do our very best to make sure that matching is as good as it possibly can be.
One of the comments we got, probably most commonly, is that guide dogs seem to be doing a lot more these days. It's involved in a huge amount of work with, for example, Microsoft to try and develop new technology to help blind people get around using their guide dog as well. Here's a comment from Diane Woodford.
I think my local guide dogs are under an awful lot of stress to keep up with the demand. But then guide dogs are doing more and more other than just guide dogs. And, have they taken on too much?
I think we always have to strive to be better than we are today. And we know that from our research, there's over 180,000 people with sight loss who rarely leave home alone. And we know that a guide dog is not suitable for all of them. So by developing our My Guide service, we've helped over 2,000 people partner up with a volunteer, go out into their community, go to work, go to visit their friends and families. Through our children's service, we've helped hundreds of parents and their children get the best out of their early years and education. So I think we have to challenge ourselves continually to help as many people as we possibly can in many different ways.
It's always interesting to me that the kind of impact you have as an organisation can sometimes impact on the kind of feedback that you get. And interestingly, setting up this conversation and, you know, looking at last week's programme and the conversations we had with many people on air, a lot of them said, in addition to other people who had mentioned this, that, you know, they were almost almost nervous about coming forward and criticising guide dogs because they might end up being pushed to the back of the queue when it came to a point where, you know, they were applying for their next guide dog. Now, I'm pretty sure no one in guide dogs has ever suggested such a thing, but does it highlight to you the impact of the work that you do equals the impact of the guide dog and the service and all of that to the extent that people might not come forward and give you feedback and constructive criticism of your organisation?
I would really encourage them to, because that's the only way we can improve by listening and having that two-way dialogue.
Interesting topic, this one, discussing the issue of unwanted touch.
All blind and partially sighted people, lots of examples of people, I suppose, meaning well and trying to help. Actually, personally, I found it really weird that people should think that when you're approaching somebody who can't see you, it's okay to do it without saying anything. That just seems to be just so counterintuitive. I don't understand why that happens. But yeah, I was on standing on the railway platform in a quiet station, and I thought I was on my own until the train kind of came to a stop. And what I would normally do when I'm on my own is actually find the side of the train and feel along it until I find the door. But on this occasion, I didn't need to, because as I was standing there, my rucksack was grabbed fairly violently, and I was yanked along like a piece of luggage. And you have to fight yourself not to swear and steam at that, because it could have been anything.
I think stations and public transport tend to be like hot spots for these kind of weird encounters. I post a lot of stuff on Facebook when it happens to me, just because I find that kind of writing that down and trying to slot some gags in there and just sort of see the funny side of stuff tends to make me feel better than anything else about it. So I'm sitting on a train. This guy comes and he gets on and he does the whole like kind of gentle squeeze of the shoulder so that I know I'm being addressed. And he says in a very soothing voice, completely uninvited, he says, I just want you to know that there are people like me who understand how difficult every day must be for you. Oh dear.
Sorry, I couldn't laugh.
I know. And it's good intentions, right? I mean, people think it's a tricky one because it's always done with the best intentions, right? And in some cases, like travelling around London in rush hour, for example, people trying to help, however badly they're doing it, that is the last vestige of positivity that you'll ever see from humanity. So I don't want to kind of chide people too much because they mean well. Do you know what I mean?
Blindness and partial sight and the differences between both. Now, Julie, you're in a rather interesting position here because you have been fully sighted, then partially sighted, then completely blind.
When I was partially sighted from the age of 18 to 31, I felt like I didn't belong anywhere. I didn't belong in the sighted world and I didn't belong in the blind world. It wasn't until I went blind at the age of 31 that I moved away from the sighted world towards the blind world, and there was a group of people that were suddenly like me, people that couldn't see, and I found that very liberating. And behind that community of people too was also support services that enabled me to, you know, be the best blind person I could be.
In your case, Kerry, you are blind and you have been since birth. So going by what you've heard from Julie, that the suggestion is that you must be happy being blind. Is that right?
Yeah, that sounds really odd, doesn't it? Yeah, you know what though? Yes, absolutely, I am, to be fair. You know, I'd rather be blind than partially sighted, and I don't mean that in any, you know, offensive or disrespectful way whatsoever. But I think it's just, say, it's kind of handy to just be able to say, oh yeah, no, I can't see, that's it now, you know, and there's no sort of like, can you see this out? Can you see that? Or maybe you see that at night or in the day or something, you know, and I'm just blind and I'm just blind, you know. So, yes, I think I'm much happier being blind than either if I'd lost it or being partially sighted, absolutely.
Well, we're talking this week on The Weekly Connect about using your white cane and the likes and dislikes of using it. Well, on the line now is Sarah from Manchester, who had a rather interesting experience this week with her White Cane. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve.
So you took your white cane with you for the first time. You didn't use it, but you took it with you. Am I right?
No. I held it in my hand.
Have you used it before? Have you been trained on it? Have you just had one?
I've had one for 35 years. I haven't needed one. I was thinking about this the other day. I've needed one for 9 years, but I've never used one because I don't like them.
What is it you don't like?
I don't like the label that goes along with them.
Mm. Are you self-conscious with it?
Yeah, definitely.
Had you ever taken your cane out with you before?
I started taking it in a bag for about a year or so, but I've never actually brought it out to the world, you know. It's yeah. Never seen the light of day.
But it did this week.
It did, yeah. Just because I was getting fed up with having to explain myself all the time. And I was just having a bad day, and I thought, I can't be bothered with the people asking me too many questions. So I just wanted to speak for me today.
So the question is, the next time you go out with your white cane and you take it with you, do you think you might open up and use it?
Honestly, oh, this is going to sound a bit negative, but no. I think that's going to take me a while.
Mm.
It took me so long to get to that stage. I think it's going to take me a while to... I think it's going to take me a while now to feel comfortable just having it as like an accessory.
So today on the Weekly Connect, we thought we'd talk about mainstream versus specialist education. Stacey Rowe, we'll start with you. What's your experience? Is it mainstream or specialist for you?
So I was always educated in mainstream education. So I have no experience of special education. Primary school was always mainstream education. I don't think that was ever up for debate. But when it came to secondary school, it was a big deal in terms of where should I go. My family were very keen for me not to go to a special school. Having said that, my mother didn't want me to go to a mainstream school either, because I think she was quite worried about bullying and things like that, and particularly... But I was, you know, about 12 or something, and I was adamant that actually I wanted to go to the mainstream school because I wanted to be with my friends, my peers. And in the end, that's where I went. And it was fine, absolutely fine.
Victoria, what's your experience?
Hi. Well, I had a pretty interesting experience because I was a partially sighted kid in a mainstream school to start off with before I lost my sight completely. And I think what really saved me was that my sister had a friend in university who was blind. So she knew that being blind was not like the end of the world. So they took me to a special school far away from where I lived, and I had to board at the age of 7.5. And actually, I was excited because I thought it was going to be so much fun to go to a school where I'd never been to boarding school before. And I was like, wow, a whole house full of children would just run riot. That's what I thought. So I was so happy.
John Ram, what's your experience been?
So I was born with a condition and was totally blind by the age of 10 months. And I'm a bit older than you guys, so I'm 52. Which puts me into sort of school age at the end of the 60s. But I think in the UK at that point, there was very little thought about schooling in mainstream. So I went to specialist school from when I was five, ended up in St. Vincent's in Liverpool. And then when I got to secondary school age, they sent me to Worcester, which was the place to go apparently at the time.
I went to Worcester.
Did you? Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, all the best people. No,
yes, we did.
We are talking about blogging and vlogging and audio blogs and all that stuff. Lucy, I'll start with you. You blog about makeup. Well, you actually vlog about makeup. Maybe you should first of all tell us what the difference between a blog and a vlog is.
Yeah, I do both. It's very interesting. So I blog less than I vlog. I love vlogging. Basically, vlogging is just me getting the camera out, hopefully pointing at my face, but you know, the blind issue makes it so that sometimes, you know, my eyebrows get cut off and my boyfriend's like, Lucy, point at your face. Then the blogging I do probably about once, twice a month, really, and that's just on my Yesterday's Wishes blog in text. So you don't often get a lot of people blogging and about makeup if they're blind, and I think that's why people are interested. A lot of people actually try to prove me wrong, like on my video, Blind Girl Does Her Own Makeup, they're like, well, you're looking at the brush, you can obviously see it, and there's all these conspiracy theories in the comments, and I'm like, no, I really can't, I'm really sorry, it probably looks like I am, so it's probably like sight.
Dipti, your blog is called Disability and Me, and it kind of echoes, I guess, what Lucy is trying to do with her blog, which is to educate people about disability, life with a disability, and all of it, the various aspects of it. For example, one of yours is Disability and the Worst Interview. Tell us about that.
So that was one of my latest blog posts, actually, and that was about an interview I had a few years ago after I graduated. It was really upsetting to me because it was like an internship, which would have been another country, and the country is a developing country, so not necessarily the best infrastructure or anything like that. But I thought I could do it, and I went to this interview, and I thought it was like a chance for them to ask me about my skills and my experience, but it ended up just being a massive chat about how I wouldn't be able to do things because of my disability. I don't know whether they thought I was being really naive, but it wasn't the right forum to be discussing my disability, and I just felt really upset afterwards, and I'd never really talked to many people about it, and I was just thinking about a topic to write for my blog and thinking, actually a lot of my posts are quite positive, whereas that doesn't mean I haven't had bad experiences, so I thought, you know, this is a perfect opportunity to write about it.
Dipti Bidressa and Lucy Edwards, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
From CEOs of large charities and individuals talking passionately about their issues, it's amazing the range of people we get to talk to on this show from all walks of life. Thank you to everyone that's joined in on our discussion so far, and if you want to get your voice heard, you can email us, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk, or tweet us at rnibradio, #theweeklyconnect. We're always on the lookout for new stories to cover, so do get in touch.
Your child is never too young to have an eye test. Children don't have to be able to read to have an eye test. In fact, some eye tests can be conducted from birth. A child's eyes are more sensitive to bright light, so always protect your child's eyes when out in the sun. And if you have a family history of eye disease, regular checkups are essential, as some eye conditions may not show symptoms.
Find out more by visiting rnibconnectradio.org.uk. The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Welcome back. Now, one of the most popular features that people seem to enjoy is Pause for Thought. We've selected some of the best to revisit, and let's start off with Lynn and Lucy.
My name's Lynn Holdsworth. I live in Bangor, Northern Ireland. And I've got with me Lucy, my six-year-old Labrador, who's an owner-trained guide dog. I had quite a few dogs from Guide Dogs UK. I think I had 5 dogs. My last one sadly died very suddenly when she was 6, and I urgently needed another dog. So I was living and working in London. I was going to college. I had a really busy social life, and I really could not do without a dog. So I spoke to Guide Dogs the day after she died, and they told me that it was likely to be at least a year before they could give me another dog. I was gutted about that, and then about 6 weeks later, I was walking along the platform on Liverpool Street, and I almost fell under a tube train. So I kind of decided at that point, I really need a dog, even if it's a terrible dog. I just need a dog to keep me away from the edge of these trains. I'm really frightened here. So I started looking around the rescue centres. If something's too good to be true, it usually is. So I found this Labrador in a little rescue centre in Northwest London, and I decided to take her home and train her. She really was a problem dog. The first day I took her to work, she ate through the boss's telephone and network cable. A few days later, she actually peed in her own ear at a meeting. And I don't know how a dog can do that, but she did it. So this was the nightmare dog from hell. It really was. But do you know, at that point, I was splitting up with my husband. I was going to be homeless because I couldn't afford to keep the house on by myself. I think I was losing my job. Everything seemed to be going wrong. And I was determined this project was going to work for me. So I stuck all the bad stuff. I'm very arrogant. Look, I thought to myself, I've had 5 guide dogs before. I can do this. I can train the badness out of this dog. So the first few days were just really familiarising her with the lead, taking her on the tube, and just trotting around, letting her get to know the area. Then on about day 5, I decided to put a harness on her, and I thought this is going to be such a disaster. So I had a harness that I bought from the internet, and I took her from my street, which I knew really well. So when I knew we were coming up to a lamppost, I purposely let her slam me into it, and I let out a big scream, ow, and jumped right back. And you know, ever since then, she's been really cautious. Actually, the guiding wasn't the hard bit at all. Apart from steps, for some reason, she would put her paws on a bottom step, but she would not stop for the top step. She used to barrel down the steps. That went on for about 6 months. So that one was quite difficult. After I felt like Lucy had reached a reasonable standard, I contacted guide dogs because I was under the impression that all I had to do was train her up and they would certify her, because that's what used to happen. But I think they got quite upset. So they've refused to certify her and they've refused to give me the public access standards that they work to. There's pros and cons to having an owner-trained guide dog. So some of the cons would be that it does cost a fortune. I cannot take her on a plane because there's a bit of a grey area legally around where non-certified service dogs can travel. So I can take her everywhere else legally, so she comes to public places with me. Everything's good in that respect. The pros, just the pride, the buzz of walking down the street with a dog that you've trained. And she just does it beautifully, and I am so proud of where we've come from and where we've got to. She's a brilliant little dog. I probably wouldn't have gone down this road if there hadn't been such a waiting list. I've had 5 good to excellent dogs from Guide Dogs UK, and I totally support the work that they're doing, but I really couldn't do without a dog. I don't feel I had a choice here. I would really recommend that for people who haven't had a guide dog from a school, I probably wouldn't do it. You really need to know what to expect from a dog before you own a train. But I think if you know what to expect, you've got the confidence, the time, the money, and a lot of patience, there's no reason why you can't do it. Caveat here, I definitely picked the wrong dog and I would not make that mistake again. Not that I think she's the wrong dog now, she's just perfect. But with Lucy, I would say it took me about 2.5 years, which is a very long time. You should see her now. She's gentle, she's lovely, she's a good little guide dog. She's really everything I want a guide dog to be.
Wow, that sounded like a real intense journey Lynn went on there. And another epic journey is with Steve Bates, who decided to carry on climbing blind.
So, Steve, welcome and congratulations.
Thanks very much. Yeah, cheers. Thanks for having me in today.
So, take me back to 2011 when you'd come over from New Zealand, you'd settled up in Moray, and what were you doing then?
So I actually came to the UK in May of 2000, so I'd been here quite a while. But in 2011 up in Moray, I was an outdoor instructor. So I worked with disadvantaged young children for a particular charity, and we basically took disadvantaged young people out climbing, cycling, all that kind of outdoor activity stuff to, you know, to improve people's confidence and things like that, and, you know, show the world, or certainly these youngsters, that you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to, you know, be at school, that, you know, there's plenty of other things outside of school that you can succeed at in life. And I was certainly like that when I was at school. I was no brainstorm child. So, you know, I left when I was 15 and cracked on with a carpentry career. And So, but I ended up in Moray in Scotland, of all places, which is absolutely stunning and beautiful. And then I had the fateful day on the 14th of June in 2011. So, yeah, which kind of changed things around a bit.
I was going to say, it's not exactly the ideal news to receive when you're a mountain instructor. I mean, I know we both climb and we're both blind, but actually there's a lot of visual safety that you're expected to do.
Yeah, I think so. We do what we do, and it's fine when you're, you know, putting yourself or your good friends at risk. That's okay. But yeah, when you've got other people's children, which you were, you know, responsible for, that kind of changes the dynamics quite a bit. And yeah, I think it was that was my biggest concern, was I still going to be able to do my job? And when I was diagnosed, and the charity were absolutely amazing at kind of supporting me through that, but it became pretty apparent to me that things were going to have to change quite drastically, and that life of trying to become a rock climbing guide kind of ended for me, really.
Now, describe what you did over the next 2 years before the summer of 2013.
Well, I think probably similar to yourself, I didn't quite sulk for a couple of decades, but I certainly had my period of sulking, and you know, for me, it was kind of 6 to 8 weeks, I think, I think the thing that annoyed me the most is how angry I was with myself, and I couldn't, you know, like, no one understood, but, you know, I was fit, I was healthy, I didn't drink that much, I didn't smoke, and I just, you know, I really felt like, why is my body doing this to me? What have I done to you, and why do I deserve this? And that was the main thing for me, I think. I was very angry at myself for no particular reason, really. And then it all changed when I met Andy Kirkpatrick, who for those of you who have never heard of Andy, he is an amazing British climber, alpinist, big wall soloist. He's climbed El Cap now over 25 times, I think. And Andy said to me, when he found out I was going, would potentially go blind, he said, "Well, you may as well solo El Cap before you go completely blind."
And this is El Capitan out in Yosemite, a vertical 1 kilometre high rock face.
Indeed. You know, when I went out there were going to be days where it was going to be absolutely relentless. I was going to be absolutely exhausted. And soloing, you cannot afford to make mistakes. It just, you know, they could be the last mistake you ever make. So it was really important that everything I did, skills-based wise, had to be second nature, and I had to rely on my subconscious to do that.
And this is when you got in touch with me. For me, it was just terrific to know that there was somebody else out there who was singing off the same song sheet as me. I got to the top of the Old Man of Hoy, and then 2 days later, I think, after a couple of wobbly moments, you got to the top of El Cap. But tell me about the journey there, because you've been very honest about how you had last-minute doubts.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think through all of the things that I've done, people seem to think that you're inhuman in that respect, and you just go and do stuff, and you achieve everything you put your mind to. And I've had more failures in my life than I ever have had successes. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, we don't come on the radio, we don't go and meet the Queen when we've failed, so no one's really too interested, to be honest. So yeah, you know, people only see the successes, and they think it comes easy, and it's a natural thing. And, you know, people use the word talented, which I really, really despise. But through that, you know, like, it's great to be told that, but there's a lot of hard work goes into all these things. And I think the scariest thing was starting to climb, really, by far. I know that's what you want to hear, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say, for me, the first step off the ground is always the most difficult. It might be the least far to fall, but actually persuading your foot to go to the first foothold and hauling yourself up to the first ledge is always making that first move.
Yeah, but it was a second climb, a route called Lurking Fear, which sounds a lot more horrific than what it actually is. It's one of the easier climbs on El Cap. And we did that in 4 days, and I actually did some of the leading on that. And that was when, all of a sudden, I realised how difficult I was going to find it through my visual impairment. We summited out after on the fourth day, and we walked off, and actually ended up phoning my wife, Caroline. And I was in tears, because I thought, I knew that my dream of soloing El Cap was gone. Mm. You know, it was just, you know, there was a very, very realistic chance I was going to kill myself. And it didn't matter if I failed, but I had to give it a go. I couldn't walk away and not try, because that was letting everyone down.
Do you know, I mean, I do think that rock climbing is perfect for setting you up for pushing yourself that little bit further. It teaches you how to fail, but it teaches you also how to come back, because it's one of those activities where it is a series of problems that when you link them together properly, it works. Thank you very much for coming in and joining us in the studio.
Cheers, thank you.
Now, I don't know about you, but I can barely climb the stairs. What an amazing guy. What an amazing story. Let's calm it down a bit now. Roger Cole talks to Laura Kirker about his hobby, blind golf.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I'm here with Roger Cole, better known as the presenter of Pure 70s and Pure 80s. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. We're going to talk about blind golf.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, so you're a blind golfer. How long have you been playing golf for?
I've been playing for about 5 years now and competing for about just over 4, I suppose. Yeah.
How did you get into playing blind golf?
Well, I'd never played before, and it's a strange story. My wife was watching a show called Wanted Down Under, and one of the guys on it was one of the members of English Blind Golf, which is now England and Wales Blind Golf. And she was sitting there watching it and thinking, that's something that you could do. And I'm thinking, yeah, I think I could. So I just sort of pursued it from that moment, really.
And then blind golf, one of the first questions I always get asked about blind golf is, do they have a bell in the ball?
No. No, you play with proper clubs, proper balls, on proper courses. And I think the only difference in the rules of golf is we're allowed to ground the club in a hazard like a bunker.
Right.
That's the only difference. We play by all the same rules.
So how do you, as a blind golfer, how do you approach the ball?
Well, I have a guide who lines me up. Obviously, I've had lessons over the years, so I can get my body into the right sort of position. So he would sort of move me towards the ball, make sure my club is behind the ball, and then it's just a matter of muscle memory, really. You don't need to see the ball. It's more of a nice smooth stroke through the ball. So you're not trying to hit the ball, you're trying to get the ball in the way of the club.
Get the ball in the way of the club.
Yeah.
It does make sense.
It does.
So is it quite a symbiotic relationship between you and your guide?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's a 50-50, it's definitely a team sport. 50-50, you know, I might be hitting the ball, but the guide has got to get me in the right direction. Distance wise, I mean, I've got a talking watch which gives me my distance from the tee to the hole. And so I know how far I'm hitting the ball one stroke to the next.
Yeah. And when you're working out your distances, do you pace out your distances and then come back, or do you just rely on your technology?
Yeah, when it comes to being on the greens, I mean, that is probably the telling point of a relationship between the guide and the player, because I might be able to putt the ball at a certain sort of distance in my head, but the guide has got to line me up. You know, there's all the undulations of the green and everything and the distance. So I would be pacing myself out to the hole and back again. And in my head, I've got like, call it 6 paces. So I'd break that down into a type of swing which would hit the ball 6 paces away. But the guide has still got to get me in line with the flag.
And have you had any challenges since taking up blind golf?
Oh, I mean, the whole thing was a challenge, you know, from just learning to hit the ball. I must have spent a year, you know, just trying to hit the ball regularly, you know, not even in the right direction, but just hitting it. So, yeah, it's definitely a challenge, but one that has great rewards, you know. you know, when you play a brilliant shot, you know, you're jumping around for hours. It's madness.
I understand that sometimes, unless you've got like a partner or a husband or a wife or as a golfer, it's quite difficult to find guides. Is that right?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, there's a fair few sort of couples who play the circuit, you know, both on England and Wales blind golf tournaments and the internationals as well. But yes, the finding a guide is really hard at the moment. You know, there's more golfers than there's guides. Yeah. So whoever's listening and they want a guide, go for it. Because you know, it's a great team sport.
You've had 5 years of playing.
Yes.
How good are you?
I'm still getting there. It's I mean, last year was my first full season playing in every tournament. That is, you know, all the sort of standard order of merit tournaments. And I wasn't bad, but I could have done better. You know, golf's definitely a game what takes no prisoners. You know, if you're not playing well, it shows. And it did show for me last season.
Would you recommend blind golf to anybody?
Yes. Oh, definitely. If there's any blind people listening right now, pick up a club and join. Because, you know, it's changed my life. It's before golf, I was losing my sight and it was having an impact on me. Mm. But now I've got this new challenge over the last few years. It's just sort of spurred me forward, really.
So you definitely wouldn't subscribe to the adage that golf is a walk ruined?
No. I mean, that is an actual positive in it, because not only are you hitting the ball, but you're getting to walk a lovely course in the fresh air, you know, usually. I mean, at this time of year, it's getting quite cold and everything's icy, but it's just a lovely day out. It's unbelievable, you know, the feeling you get when you play something well. It's also irritating when you play it badly, but hopefully my bad days are going to be less. My good days are going to be more.
Well, so. I hope so too. Thank you so much for joining me on the Weekly Connect today, Roger. It's been a real pleasure.
Lovely being here, Laura. Thank you.
Sounds like Roger's really enjoying getting out and about there. We'll be back in a moment with more of the best bits from 2016.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Welcome back to the best bits of The Weekly Connect of 2016. Now let's go and meet someone else who's managed to broaden their horizons, is Lynette, after she got her guide dog, Pippa.
My name is Lynette Proctor. I have a guide dog and her name is Pippa. We qualified in March 2013, so I've had her sort of over 3.5 years now. We've done so many things since I got Pippa. When I first applied for a guide dog, I wasn't going out independently at all. I was having to go to hospital appointments, college counselling sessions, all supported by my mum, which for being in your early 20s, you don't really want to have to take your mum everywhere with you. My mum says that she was a brilliant guide, but when we used to walk into supermarkets, she'd get distracted by a really good deal, and then I'd be left standing in the middle of the shop, not knowing where she'd gone and what she was looking at. So having a dog, to me, felt that maybe I was going to be able to sort of look at the things that I wanted to do and maybe not prioritise the boring things like shopping and counselling and hospitals and be able to do things that were a bit more spontaneous. Not long sort of after getting her, I'd said so many times that I kept saying no to things that I wanted to start saying yes. So we agreed to travel up to the Lake District and do a lot of work with kids and young people who have got sight loss. We started traveling down to London for work and to sort of visit my friend in Birmingham a lot. So the more Pippa kind of got used to getting out and about, the more sort of relaxed she became at all these long train journeys and working in places that maybe she wasn't familiar with. I do think that Pippa comes well before my needs, remembering that when we're going out in the morning to make sure she's got everything that we need for the day. Quite often my handbag or my suitcase, if we're on long journeys, is half full of like her dog bed, her toys, her food, her water bowl, enough water for the journey. I've had to plan all the sort of stops off and everything. It's almost like having a child with you quite a lot. And we have travelled around sort of on very sort of like long train journeys where I have on occasion, sort of not long after getting her, we've stuck on a train that had been cancelled a few times and I've gone, oh no, what if she needs to go and spend which obviously she didn't. She's really well trained, but I didn't know how long she could hold it in for. It's at the point where she sort of signaled to me that she might need to go. So we've learned that long train journeys, it means that we have to make sure we've factored that sort of time into our transport, like links and everything. One of the big things about having a dog is people are constantly amazed about the work that they do, and you do have people coming up to you all the time, but sometimes it can be negative. Sometimes you can have somebody jump down in front of you and kneel on the floor at a train station and try and talk to the dog while you're walking along the platform, and people don't understand that, well, this dog's doing a job, it's trying to avoid me going onto the track, and you're suddenly squatting down and speaking to her and distracting her from my work. But then other times you might be actually needing support. If I have been sat somewhere and somebody's come over to offer me assistance but asked the stranger next to me instead, who had no idea because they weren't even with me, they were just sat on the same group of chairs. The thing is, if I hadn't had Pippa, people didn't know, because I wasn't a cane user. I used to find the cane very restricting. I used to describe it as sort of like pushing a shopping trolley where the shakes sort of go up your arm. And I found everything about using the cane quite sort of negative, whereas I'd always loved animals. So to choose to have a guide dog for me felt like a perfect thing, because I didn't see her as a negative. I saw her as something that I could interact with and something that could actually sort of force me to get out and about and do more things. And some of the things that we've done really are amazing. Like last year, me and Pippa did a fundraising challenge where we actually raised enough money to name our own guide dog Puppy, who's currently in training. And we climbed a mountain together, which, if you'd have asked me before I had her, would I have had the confidence not only to leave the front door and get out and about independently, to be able to go back to work, to be able to finish studies, to be able to just do everything that I should be able to do, but could I actually go on then and climb a mountain? Or I even learned to scuba dive and got my scuba license. There's so many different things that, yes, she's helped me get out and about, but she's also allowed me to do even more than I'd ever expected. And I don't know what I'm going to end up doing next year, because I didn't know this year that what I was going to end up doing. So it's quite exciting, but it allows me to get excited about everything as well, and allows me to sort of be who I want to be and not be sort of anything dictated to me just because of my vision.
Wow, Lynette, really doing some amazing things there. Funnily enough, I can't get the picture of a guide dog with a snorkel out of my head, but hey, that's just me. I'm so impressed with the scuba diving, I can't even swim. Now it all seems to be getting a bit more energetic here. Perhaps someone's trying to drop me some hints. Maybe a new New Year's resolution is in order. Let's meet Stuart now, who, despite being visually impaired, hasn't let it stop him getting out and flying his kite.
Hello, my name is Stuart Curtis. When I was at school at Exhall in Coventry, the bursar had a kite, which I found out later on, it's called a girl Gibson kite. And these were box kites, about 3 foot tall, and they were put in the bottom of inflatable dinghies for aircrew. So if they were in a plane and they got shot down or ended up in the channel, in the bottom of the self-inflating dinghy was an aluminium tube that contained a kite, the fabric of which was bright yellow or orange. So they clip these together, fly the kite, and the line they were flying it on was a metal antenna for the radio. So the rescue plane would fly over, see the kite, work out which way the wind's blowing, and then they could find the boat from there, pick up the aircrew. Anyway, left school and just bought loads of kites, the largest one of which I have at the moment has a wingspan of about 19 feet and it's 9.5 foot tall. Unfortunately, I broke one of the sticks on it and I can't get replacements. So flying a Morgan Mega Delta at the moment, which has a wingspan of about 13 feet. The 19 foot kite has actually got a pattern on it that looks like flames. So quite spectacular. The Morgan, it's multicoloured stripes, quite wide stripes, and at different angles as well. The kites themselves, although they're quite large and they have quite a significant lifting power, they're not really big enough to drag you away. and it's a single line kite, so you don't have to keep an eye on what the kite's doing. You can actually fly it by touch. You can tell when the line starts going slack, whether to pay up more line or wind it back in again. I like to fly things from my kites, so large flags. I've got a set of 8 foot by 5 foot flags. The Union flag, St. George, St. Andrew, the Welsh Dragon, and the Red Hand of Ulster, all in the same size, and it can look quite spectacular on a nice windy day. I was flying a kite down in Bournemouth one year, and we found a 4 foot silver inflatable alien in one of the shops on the seafront. So we rigged it up so that the alien was actually standing on the sea, and we were about 100 feet away, so people couldn't work out how it was actually standing on the water, because the line needed was quite thin, and anyone who tried to get close to it, once they sort of got close to it, we just paid the line out, so it just jumped up in the air. I'm hoping to, between now and the new year, get hold of a second-hand Christmas tree, about 6 foot tall, attach some Christmas lights to it, battery-powered ones, and actually fly that from one of my kites up on Blackheath. I've flown Christmas lights before, but without a Christmas tree and that sort of thing, or chemical snap lights. And we've had people walk 2 or 3 miles to work out what the lights are in the sky. So probably responsible for 1 or 2 reportings of UFOs. I've lost a couple of kites where the lines have snapped, and the height that I'm sort of flying at, you don't really get a chance to retrieve them. It's just, well, it's different, and it's a nice day out, really. You know, you can go down to Whitstable or the coast. There's usually good places to fly kites on the coast, or Blackheath, quite high up, generally. Lots of nice, consistent wind. Yeah, it can be quite fun.
Thanks, Stuart. I wonder if he ever got that Christmas tree off the ground. I'd love to know how that escapade went. Let's meet Maggie, an actress and mezzo-soprano singer who tells us how determined you have to be to get what you want.
I wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I was at school and just sort of floated along like everybody else does to university and thought, oh, languages, that's quite interesting. Went to uni, started to notice some kind of eye problems, just thought I needed glasses. Pootered along, ended up needing some laser treatment for stuff at the back. I didn't understand. At 19, 20, you don't know what's going on. My retina's detached. I mean, it was a very difficult time because your life, it doesn't stop, but it has to change overnight. So I finished my degree and I had just gone along thinking, oh, I'll be a medical interpreter, but I'd really always wanted to be an actor. I thought, oh, do you know what? I'm going to go to drama school. And I waddled along to Morley College. They accommodated me and my white cane, and here we are 10 years later. It was the biggest learning experience of my life. Life now it's great. I mean, yeah, I wish I could see 100%, but I love what I do. I create, I pretend to be other people for a living, and it's like being a child, and people clap. And I think mainly because my mum was obsessed with Elizabeth Taylor, she shared a birthday with her, I would see, you know, mums look after you and they nag, and that's what they do when they cook. But I saw her amazing reaction to Elizabeth Taylor on Cat in the Hot Tin Roof, and I thought, whoa, well, if this woman's getting this reaction from my mum, I would love to do that. And mum always wanted to be an actor, but, she did the normal thing. She became a welfare officer and had children. And as well as the drama training, I trained as a mezzo-soprano. It was always, you know, some kind of performing, maybe music, maybe drama. And it's nice to have the choice. It's nice to maybe do a singing thing, maybe do a mixy thing. Out of everything, I don't want to jinx my future, but out of everything, comedy roles are probably my favourite, because you get to be a complete idiot and people thank you for it. The official training started at Morley, and then I went on to CityLit, and then I found private tutors. It was scary and it was fantastic. It was everything, because a door in my head opened, and oh, God, I'm cringing as I say this, but I just saw a light. I saw a path forward, and I didn't look back. It's not easy because you'll be competing in auditions and for places in plays and concerts with people who have fantastic vision and who went to conservatory and all this kind of thing. But the most important thing is you have to want it. You have to stay focused and you have to stay positive. It's not easy, but it just helps. Sometimes with a disability, because I do see sight loss as a disability, and I don't think disability is a dirty word. I really don't. And I don't think people should avoid using it. Sometimes with a condition, you will get people saying no simply because they're scared of what you might do to yourself. They're scared about insurance things. Oh, what if she suddenly falls down the stairs that she's never fallen down before? You have to stay positive. And somebody said to me, you actually have to be a little bit better. No, you just have to be as good as them. Because when you can present to a director or a concert manager who likes you and they're like, oh my God, and she's got this level of sight loss, they want you. You make them look good. They're using a disabled person. Hooray for them. You know, it's not easy. The most important thing is establishing good connections with people that you've worked with before in the past and bringing that CV and showing them what you can do. Get good. Get really good. You don't need to be better than everybody, but you need to be good and you need to want it. You need to want it and be hungry for it. I mean, do it as a hobby by all means. Join a local company, learn the skills. But you have to want it, because that's what directors pick up on. They pick up on the energy, because if you have that energy to want it, that'll feed into the work you do.
Thank you, Maggie. A great story there. It just goes to show you, if you really want to do something, there is help out there. And if you've got the dedication and determination, you can do what you want to do. Nearly time for me to wrap up here, but I couldn't leave you without one last pause for thought.
Hello, my name is Jenny and I have a 3-year-old golden retriever cross Labrador guide dog called Patty, often referred to as Patty Pickle because she's quite mischievous. At the present time, I have completely no vision in either eye. I've been registered blind since I was about 12, but it was useful vision. So then 2 years ago, I had a detached retina, so I completely lost my sight and I don't even have light perception anymore. I got my first guide dog, Janie, in 2009, after waiting on the waiting list for 2 years. I was quite impatient when they rang me up to say that they had a match, so I was ready to take literally anything. They told me that Janie was coprophagic, which means she eats poo, which is a disgusting habit, and they said that she needed to go to somebody that had good, useful vision. Yeah, that was hard. Basically, with free running, it was very difficult. She was so disgusting that if you went out with another guide dog or another dog and they went to the toilet, she would crouch behind them as it came out. Gives Mr. Whippy a whole new meaning, literally. that was really bad. But working her, she was a little perfectionist. She was just brilliant working-wise. I had a bit of a trouble trying to adjust to getting used to having a guide dog. I was told off for overriding some of her decisions because I could see. So it was quite difficult learning not to do that. And it got much easier as time went on. In February 2014, I had a detached retina, which meant my vision went completely. Janie struggled to cope, and stress actually made her coprophagia worse, and she was having accidents indoors. The final straw came when we were in town one day and I was going to meet a friend, and to get to Marks and Spencer's you have to cross a quite busy road that's got buses coming along it. Anyway, we got to town, all of a sudden I found myself at the door of Marks and Spencer's. And I thought, uh-oh, to get here, we would have gone across the road. And she hadn't stopped at the curb. She'd gone straight across the road without me knowing. And so that was the final straw. I called out guide dogs. And again, she shot over the road without me realising. So they suggested that it wasn't safe to work her, so she was retired. I agreed that it was the right time to retire her, but of course I was really, really upset and distressed, and I was having to cope with the sight loss, sudden sight loss. And on top of that, it was just a really difficult time because the thing, when I lost my sight, the initial thought I had was, at least I have a guide dog. So when they said that I had to retire her, I was like, oh, well, now I don't have a guide dog and I'm totally blind. What am I going to do? When I had to retire Janie, I didn't know any of my local routes with a long cane because I hadn't done a long cane training at home. But in that time, it took me 4 months just to learn the route to my local supermarket, which is 10 minutes down the road. And I waited 8 months for a new dog. And in that time, it took me an hour to do that route with my long cane. It was a really, really tough time. I was very depressed and just really impatient for a guide dog. And even when I got Patty, I was struggling to cope. It took me 2 months to qualify. I love working Patty. She's amazing. In harness, she's not such a perfectionist as Janie. I say left, Patty goes right. So she's got us lost many, many a time. There was a famous time where I was doing a short block route around where I live, and Patty decided she wasn't going to listen to me and take me into the park. And thankfully, there was a guide dog instructor there, and he rescued me and took me home. So she does test my patience a lot, and my sense of direction and my orientation skills, which aren't great, especially now that I have no vision. But I can go to my local supermarket. Now takes me 10 minutes again. I can go down to a local cafe. I can meet up with friends in town independently again. With Patty that doesn't listen, I have to be really aware of where I'm going. And the long cane training did help me, because I know with like the supermarket route, I know it so well that I know where to correct Patty if she has gone off and gets us lost a bit. If you speak to any of my friends, they will tell you that my confidence since when I lost all my sight has got a lot better since I got Patty.
And that's it. My time is up. Stephen will be back with you next week. So there's nothing more for me to do except wish you a very happy 2017 from everyone here at the Weekly Connect.